16 minutes past 8, you are listening to Sabah al-Muslim on Radio Islam International. Time now for the Big Picture program. Brother Bukar Dawji, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Are you sounding fresher, younger since you returned from the Middle East?
Well, then I really missed you. I really missed you. While I was relaxing on the beach in Beirut or in the mountains of Lebanon, or just chilling in Amman, I missed you.
Yeah, I was telling the listeners about those pictures that you were sending me.
Don't go into that.
On a more serious note, what's the latest? What's the situation like in the Middle East? You've traveled there many times, but what were some of your observations in terms of your most recent visit?
Well, you know, I'm in somewhat of a very somber mood today. Very worried about the unfolding events in Palestine, which is, of course, very sad indeed. So no light stuff today at all. Maybe in the end, yes. Now, you know, there are many places in the world that you can visit and have a fulfilling experience, a great holiday. But the Middle East region has the greatest impact, especially for Muslims. That is mainly because so much is happening there, good things and bad things. Of course, there are religious issues, there's politics, there's death and destruction, hope and hopelessness. All of these are in the headlines every day. So when you leave there, you have all kinds of feelings, usually mixed feelings about the future of this volatile region, which I often refer to as the muddled East. And as we departed from there last Saturday, one lady in our group cried bitterly. She was so happy that she prayed in Al-Aqsa on the Friday the week before, and so depressed that just a week later Al-Aqsa was on Friday was on lockdown, and everyone in the group was so sad about that. Now, first up was Egypt, and while we all enjoyed visiting the spectacular sites, the pyramids, the Sphinx, the Citadel of Salahuddin, and the evening cruise on the Nile with the whirling dervishes, etc., etc. The etc. is something I skipped. It had to do with some entertainment by a lady, so I went on top of the boat to see spectacular Cairo by night. As you can see, Maulana, I'm being deliberately cryptic because already it was... the temperature was already 30 degrees, and that was 8 o'clock in the evening. Yes, so as I was saying, a great time was had by all, yet there was an awareness of the dire economic situation in which the country, Egypt, is plunged, in fact, the entire region, and it is getting progressively worse. The hotel in which we stayed was almost empty. Tourism was still at a very low level, and tourists, the millions who just over 5 or 6 years ago poured into Egypt, contributed greatly during those times to the economy. At the pyramids, the guides and vendors selling souvenirs tried in vain to sell their wares, but it was mainly the locals who were there, and of course they didn't need Egyptian souvenirs. Speaking of Egyptians visiting the pyramids, let me tell you about an encounter that had me very, very surprised indeed. A young lady in her early 20s was manning the metal detector and scanner at the entrance of our hotel. Hardly anyone was passing through. In casually chatting to her, I remarked that it must be quite boring to stand there for hours and hours on end with almost nothing to do. And she said, yes, the hotel is very quiet. And I replied, yes, not many people are also visiting the pyramids we went to in the morning. And she replied, yes, I have not seen the pyramids also. I thought that I had not heard correctly, Maulana, and asked her to repeat. And she said, yes, she never visited the pyramids. I couldn't believe it. The pyramids are right there in Cairo, on the edge of the city, just on the outskirts, just a few kilometers away. And she hadn't seen them? Wow. I was quite shocked. I thought she was joking. But no, she was deadly serious. And the reason that she gave, she said that she was working from early in the morning till the evening, and after that she went home. had dinner and went to sleep, and next morning it was the same routine over and over again. She said, there was no time. There was no time. Good heavens. That was so sad, eh? People from far away places in the world have seen the pyramids, millions and millions of them, but not this young lady. I mentioned this to our guide, and he said, yes, it's true. Actually, many residents of Cairo haven't seen the pyramids. His own mother, now 55 years old, only saw the pyramids and Sphinx 4 years ago. That was absolutely mind-boggling. I couldn't believe it. But there you are. But on the political level, Maulana, there was also a feeling of despair and desperation in the region. I spent... I usually speak to as many people as possible when I'm in the region to get some sense of what's happening and what is the actual thinking of the people, the taxi drivers, guides, waiters, academics, friends that I know for a very long time. The overriding yearning is we are praying for another Salahuddin Ayyubi to deliver us from this horrible situation we are in. Where are you, Salahuddin Ayyubi? That is the cry in the whole region. And on the question of the Saudi-Qatar standoff, it was almost the unanimous view that it was just a silly manufactured crisis that is for the benefit of America and Israel. What about the big one? The big one. And this is something that I interrogate all the time when I am there. Syria. Again, the view was that it is a proxy war. All those involved are there to pursue their own interests and agendas. It's about power and consolidating it. If you get more partners on your side, you are more powerful. Iran, Iraq, Hezbollah, and Russia are on the side of the brutal Assad regime. This group cannot allow Syria to fall into the hands of the other side. It is, of course, of strategic importance to them. We know that Russia has got a military site there in Tartus, a base. The other side is the Gulf states, the Gulf countries, Saudi Arabia and the UAE, plus the US and Israel. Only Qatar is not playing ball, and so pressure is put on it to come into the fold. Turkey is also worried that the Kurds in Iraq and Syria are trying very hard to control large parts of the land, which they say belongs to them, to restore the original Kurdistan. The various groups fighting Assad forces are usually fighting one another. And America's role is, well, shall I say, very uncertain. Donald Trump said that he will not get involved in Syria. Then he got involved, supporting a large anti-Assad militant group, and of course also the Kurdish group, the YPG, which is in northern Syria. And yesterday, the White House said officially that it is stopping the transfer of arms and supplies to these groups. That means that the Assad regime, and by implication Iran and Russia, will be emboldened to crush the opposition. And so ordinary Syrians will continue to suffer and die. But let me leave Syria and focus on something a bit lighter, and that is the airhead Donald Trump. Dear listeners, I told you long ago that Donald Trump is a dangerous nutcase, a loony. And yesterday, once again, I was proved correct. Here is an article just published in the Washington Times. Psychiatry professors from several top universities, that is Columbia, Harvard, and Yale, who argue Donald Trump is unfit for the presidency, are calling on the U.S. Congress to take lawful steps to remove him from office. The professor's letter to Congress says the president's supposed mental unraveling is hurting his ability to govern. They say the power of the presidency has accentuated Mr. Trump's failings with devastating effects. His psychological isolation, including his tenuous relationship to reality. Oh, I like that, eh? Tenuous relationship to reality. He hasn't got his feet on the ground. or he doesn't even know what's happening around him, has led to the dangerous isolation of the United States from the rest of the world. They continue by saying, our Constitution has provisions for removing any president who is unable to discharge the duties of office. For the sake of our country and the world, we urge our elected representatives to summon their courage so that lawful steps can be taken to end the Trump presidency. So, there you are, folks. There you are. A dangerous lunatic is the most powerful man in the world, and he has his finger on the nuclear button. So be afraid. Be very afraid. Who knows what he will do if he is in a corner. And already things are hotting up. You know, Maulana, here's the funny thing. Some son-in-law has been summoned to come before Congress on Monday to answer charges that he colluded illegally with the Russians. And right here, our parliamentary committee has summoned Jacob Zuma's son, Dudu Zane, to appear before it to answer questions about his involvement with the Guptas.
Mm.
Isn't it amazing that new revelations about both families are coming out almost every weekend?
The situation at Masjid Al-Aqsa.
Yes, 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 indeed. Now, it looks like we are moving from one standoff to another. Of course, I told you the Saudi-Qatar Cold War seems to be thawing a little. The latest news on that front is that the 13 original demands made on Qatar have now been reduced to 6. And Qatar has also taken steps to pass a decree to relook at its anti-terrorism legislation and tighten this up. So it looks like the two sides may soon kiss and make up, and nobody will lose face. It's something of a win-win situation. And now we have the situation at Al-Aqsa. Will Israel remove the metal detectors, the scanners, and the security cameras? That is the big question. The score so far is that the Israeli president has said that it should be removed. That's the Israeli president, Reuven. And Shin Bet, the Israeli security establishment, also wants it removed. The Israeli police, on the other hand, said that it should remain in place. Netanyahu was in discussion most of the night with all his security bodies and said that he will decide what to do. And King Abdullah of Jordan has asked for it to be removed. Now, it is my view that this move by Netanyahu was a miscalculation. He expected the Palestinians to pass through the scanners and enter Al-Aqsa, although with some reluctance, thinking that Palestinians will never think of not praying at Al-Aqsa, at this very holy site. He thought just as they pass through myriads of checkpoints as part of their lives, this security checkpoint outside the Al-Aqsa gates will be taken as just another unpalatable hurdle, and they will have to pass through. Well, it didn't turn out that way, did it? The huge backlash from Palestinians was unexpected, and the bold decision of the Palestinian leadership not to pray inside Al-Aqsa grounds but outside its walls is a huge confrontation against Israel. And the Palestinians resolved to continue with this action indefinitely until the metal detectors and cameras are removed. Wow, that really put a big spanner in Netanyahu's plans. The Palestinians had dramatically escalated the stakes. And to raise it further, they announced yesterday that all masajid in the wider Jerusalem area must close and all Muslims must join the Jummah Salah outside the Haram al-Sharif. A dramatic, dramatic confrontation. And if the Israeli police decided to take any action, you can be sure that there will be violence and, of course, injuries, death and destruction. Will Netanyahu, that is the question, will Netanyahu back down and avoid the bloodshed? Now, here's the context of what happened. As we all know, last Friday, three Palestinians attacked Israeli soldiers and police and killed two officers. This was the first time this has happened at Al-Aqsa, where weapons were used. in other words, an armed attack by Palestinians. First time. So given that this was the first time, do you then impose a security scanning checkpoint on the entire Palestinian population entering Al-Aqsa? It is a very disproportionate response. In other words, completely unnecessary. And if it is an unnecessary move, the installation of the scanners, that is, then it is not worth the violence that will follow. This is my guess, that Netanyahu will weigh up the pros and cons of leaving the metal detectors in place, and in the end, he will decide that they should be removed. That is, in any case, my guess. And now to the question of what the installation of these metal detectors mean to the Palestinians. Well, you know, the widespread interpretation is that it is an interference in the sovereignty of the Haram al-Sharif, and further, that it is a step by Israel to slowly take over control of Al-Aqsa, and perhaps even divide it. The first step, and gradually more and more steps. In other words, the thin edge of the wedge. Well, Maulana, to be honest, this is not quite accurate. This is not the first step, installing these scanners and cameras. Israel has taken more serious steps, which started a long time ago, in order to gradually get the Palestinians used to the idea that Jews must have more and more access to the Haram al-Sharif. Let me take you through the story. You know, over 150 years ago, during the Ottoman rule, there was an understanding in place that only Muslims have a right to pray at the Haram al-Sharif, and that non-Muslims in small numbers can visit for a short time, but must not pray there. Then in 1967, Israel captured East Jerusalem from Jordan in the Six-Day War. Al-Aqsa is located in East Jerusalem. Al-Aqsa continued to be under the control of Jordan, and the arrangement of Muslims praying and non-Muslims not praying there continued. If you remember, in 2000, Ariel Sharon entered the Al-Aqsa ground with 1,000 police and caused a huge reaction from the Palestinians. It was known as the Second Intifada. That cooled off with just some sporadic incidents thereafter. But right-wingers were pushing, and steadily more and more entered, protected by Israeli soldiers. Then another big response in 2014. There were daily clashes at that time between Israeli police and Palestinian youth at what Palestinians perceived to be a change in the commitment to the long-standing arrangement and understanding Netanyahu had with King Abdullah. And when this second intifada broke out, Netanyahu phoned King Abdullah of Jordan and said, no, there is no change. And there was an agreement, a commitment that was put in place. The first one was all Israeli Knesset parliament members were to be kept off the Al-Aqsa grounds. Israel would refrain from age or gender limitations on Muslim access. That was the next commitment. And Israel would stop provocative Jewish activists from the site and limit religious Jewish groups' entry into the site. And Jordan would prevent young Palestinians from surreptitiously entering the compound at night. So these were the commitments. So after this 2014 agreement, there was some measure of calm. But in the past year, Israel has not stuck to this commitment. In January 2016, Israel's Minister of Internal Security nominated Yoram Halevi, as head of police for Jerusalem. Now, Halevi has steadily changed the rules that were agreed to by Netanyahu and King Abdullah. He allowed Jews who visited the grounds of Al-Aqsa to pray softly. That went against the long-standing rules of over 150 years. On June 29th, Halevi himself went with a group to the Haram al-Sharif in order to commemorate the killing of a 13-year-old Israeli girl at the settlement of Kiryat Arba. While he was there, he was given a priestly blessing a prayer was conducted. Imagine that, eh? The chief of Jerusalem's police, whose job it was to ensure the commitment of non-Muslims not praying at Al-Aqsa, was supposed to be upheld. He's supposed to have upheld the ruling, but he himself was praying there. The video of this went viral and greatly upset the Palestinians. In the last month, another commitment that Netanyahu made about age-based limitation of Palestinians' entry has been ignored. Young Palestinians were prevented from attending on two occasions because large groups of Jews were visiting the grounds of Al-Aqsa, and according to the Israeli police, it was a security measure to keep young Palestinians out. And perhaps the most provocative act is the breaking of the promise Netanyahu made to King Abdullah about not allowing Israeli politicians, Knesset members, from entering Al-Aqsa grounds. Now, you have to keep an eye on this one. On the 23rd of July, that's about 2 days away, this ban will fall away and Knesset members will once again enter, as did Ariel Sharon in 2000, which is, of course, a very, very dangerous and provocative move. So, dear listeners, the erection of metal detectors may be seen as a move to show that Israel is doing something that implies a step towards controlling Al-Aqsa. But in my view, the more dangerous action is to allow more and more Jews onto the holy grounds under police protection, something that the Palestinians have been violently confronting for a very long time. Israel hopes that Palestinians will get used to the idea or maybe tired of opposing it, and slowly retreat under the violent onslaught of the police and soldiers protecting the groups that enter. And eventually, days can be set aside for Jews to pray or a section blocked off for them. The scenario is a creeping danger to Al-Aqsa, far more serious than the scanners. Okay, here's another factor that Netanyahu has to consider. If he does not remove the metal detectors and if the protests continue and escalate, the impact will be on King Abdullah of Jordan, who is in charge of Al-Aqsa. His credibility will be undermined, and that could result in some instability in Jordan, which is seen as an ally to Israel, or at least on peaceful terms. So he will be undermined. Another factor is that Israel at this time sees its relationship with the Gulf states as being the closest that it has ever been any time before. So any escalation around Al-Aqsa will greatly anger people right across the Arab world and set back growing ties with these states that Israel has. Could Netanyahu risk this just for a few metal detectors that are in the first place not necessary? I think all of these factors, and especially the view of Shin Bet, will prevail, and the scanners may be removed, maybe not immediately, but they will be removed. It's not just worth, it's just not worth keeping them there. The price to pay will be too high. That, dear listeners, is my calculated guess, my assessment. And this just in now, breaking news, I just read on the Jerusalem Post website that police chief of Jerusalem, and that is Yoran Halevi, announced yesterday that Jews, last night, that Jews will not be allowed into the Haram al-Sharif for now, because a group that was allowed in this week while the Palestinians were outside, they misbehaved. And in fact, I saw a video which probably portrayed that they were running around the grounds of Al-Aqsa waving Israeli flags. So perhaps Halevi realizes that this could be akin to waving the red flag towards the Palestinians, and of course that is a very dangerous move. Netanyahu was in an emergency meeting, as I said, with his cabinet last night. It must be have been quite a tough debate with his colleagues, the right-wing colleagues. It's not his decision alone. He may want to lift the detectors, scanners, but even if he wanted to, he's got very hard-line right-wing partners in his government, and they're never ever ready to make any compromises with the Palestinians, especially if the Palestinians threaten any confrontation. So Netanyahu will have a hard time convincing them to remove the metal detectors. The president of Israel, Ruben Rivlin asked the president of Turkey, Recep Erdogan, to cool tensions, but already last night a synagogue was stoned in Istanbul. So things are getting pretty hot. In the end, no one can say for certain what will happen. Netanyahu will push to remove the scanners, but his right-wing parties will say we can't give in to the Palestinians. And the Palestinians, of course, will not give in.
Okay. Lights at the... Uncle Abia, are you still there? Okay, it seems like something going a bit cuckoo's there, if I can call it that, in terms of the telephone lines. Let's see if we can get Ibi Dowji back on the line. Giving us a very good update in terms of what's happening there in Masjid Al-Aqsa at the moment. And let's hope he's right and that it was a huge miscalculation from Netanyahu, and that inshallah it will things will at least go back to normal. Not that normal was an acceptable situation in terms of it was difficult all along for Palestinians to access Masjid Al-Aqsa. Many times they would impose that restriction of only those above the age of 50, etc. But our engineer is trying to get hold of Ibi Dowji, trying to get him back on the line, and then we'll see what transpired there. I know what he's going to say. He'll probably make a humorous comment about the line dropping. Okay, Uncle Abi, can you hear me?
I can hear you, Sheikh Dr. Habibi. I think somebody hacked the line.
Okay, so you were saying?
I think I was talking to myself for a while there. Was I talking about Turkey when we left off?
No, we didn't get that part.
Okay, so do you remember? Were you paying attention there, Molan?
Yes, I was paying attention. You just rounded up that point about this being a big miscalculation. It's your analysis, and then hopefully that things will return to normal.
Yeah. Anyway, let me just say, did I speak about the step taken by Yoram Halevi?
Yes.
He announced yesterday that Jews will not be allowed in.
Yes.
Okay, so the president of Israel, Reuven Rivlin, asked the president of Turkey, Recep Erdogan, to cool tension, but already last night a synagogue was stoned in Istanbul. So things are hotting up steadily. In the end, no one can say for certain what will happen. Netanyahu will push to remove the scanners, I feel. But of course, his right-wing parties will say we can't give in to the Palestinians. And the Palestinians, of course, will not give in. Violence will therefore escalate. And so let us all make dua that good sense will prevail and that lives will not be lost, inshallah. Now, latest news is that Netanyahu seems to have lost the first round to the right-wingers. The scanners will stay, and it will be up to the Israeli police to decide when they will be removed. So the door is still open there for some sort of decision to be made about that. Meanwhile, Israel has blocked off many streets leading up to the old city where Al-Aqsa is located, and has put up barriers at the entrance of the street leading up to what is referred to as the Lion's Gate, where the scanners are located. Hundreds of Israeli soldiers and police are spreading out throughout Jerusalem. There's every indication that this is developing into a third intifada. Today, Jumma is going to be a tough one, and here in South Africa, in every masjid, you will hear a talk about Palestine and Al-Aqsa. And in fact, I was quite surprised that it was mentioned on Al Jazeera that South African scholars and the ulema have called on all the masajids to speak about Al-Aqsa. So please go early, and let us all make fervent dua for the people of Palestine in this very difficult time.
Light at the end of the tunnel.
Light at the end of the tunnel. Well, you know, I just got this WhatsApp message now. Laugh at your own mistakes and you will have a long life. Laugh at your wife's mistakes and you will shorten your life.
You'll have a quick death.
Yes. Imran came home early from school. His mother asked him, why you came so early? And Imran replied, because I was the only one in class who answered the question correctly. And his mother said, oh, beta, I always know that you are a genius. I'm so proud of you. What was the question? Imran replied, the principal came to the class and asked who put super glue on the teacher's chair. Okay, here's the last one. A young boy came home from school and told his mother, I had a big fight with my classmates. He called me a sissy. And the mother said, So what did you do? And he replied, I hit him with my handbag.
Uncle Levy, as always, Jazakumullah for your time. Much appreciated.
Always a pleasure, Maulana. Let us all make dua for the people of Palestine.
Indeed. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
It's now 14 minutes to 9. The lines are open, 011-854-1548 for this morning's On Air Challenge. Maradaya will join us in studio. The topic is, if you could share one thing about Islam, whether it's one ayah, one hadith, one ruling, one incident with the rest of the world, what would it be and why? Some people have been answering via WhatsApp. We will accept that, but you can't be part of the competition. You have to call in to be part of the competition. The one is the beautiful seerah of Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wasallam. The other one says, I will demonstrate the truth of Islam. I will share the facts of conception of a child and its growth in the womb. You know, as obviously mentioned in the Quran Kareem. On Facebook, one brother said, I will share with them the concept of istinja in Islam. Another one says, good character of a Muslim. So the lines are open, 011-854-1548.
The Big Picture program was sponsored by Steering Auto Inspector Car in Benoni, the thinking person's car dealership. Steering Auto, the home of pre-loved cars.